Let's start with the current situation of the Ukrainian army. We know that there are reports they're talking about Ukraine needs to mobilize 200,000 citizens by the end of the year to compensate for losses that they had. And how do you find right now the situation of the Ukrainian army?
That's in a dire situation. Ukraine has a very large military, and there are aspects of this military that are very well trained, competently led, and well equipped. But there are larger components of the military that are not fully trained, not competently led, and poorly equipped, which means that you can't speak of a uniformity when talking about the Ukrainian military. But even the most competently led, well-equipped, well-trained forces have sustainability factors. We can go back to, the beginning of modern warfare. Let's go to World War I, because that's probably a war that might more accurately reflect some of the battlefield conditions. Troops had to be rotated out of the trenches and they'd go insane, being bombarded constantly, subjected to continuous pressure, not being able to sleep, not being able to be fed properly, and just the wear and tear on nerves. Even the most highly trained soldier, when subjected to continuous bombardment, falls victim to what they call shell shock. Today we know PTSD, but you go back to World War I, they called it shell shock. That's the state of the Ukrainian military today. You have forces that are in continuous contact with the Russians in some of the most brutal attrition style warfare imaginable, and they're not able to be rotated out, and so they lose their combat efficiency. So, even those the parts of the Ukrainian forces that could be called competent are now less so. And this is across the battlefield. There are some parts of the battlefield that the fighting is less intensive than others. But in the places where there's extreme intensity, high intensity, Chasiv Yar, up north of Kharkov, this is where the Ukrainians are pouring in the bulk of their reserves, and these reserves are being ground down to nothing and spit out by the Russians dead. This is the reality, and there's a reason why Ukraine needs 200,000 troops. It's because they are running out of men. They've run out of men. They don't have any more. They're down to hijacking men off of buses, pulling men out of shopping centers, stripping men away from their families, taking children out of the men's arms, leading them off to be what, trained, effectively? No, they're getting minimal training. Are thrown to front lines simply to hold a position while Ukraine desperately looks for a solution that isn't coming. There are some Ukrainian troops, numbered in the thousands, that are being trained by NATO outside of Ukraine. These forces will come back, but now what happens? They get fed into the meat grinder. And so all of their trainings were not. They're fed into a situation that they're not in control of. The Russians are able to inflict horrific casualties on them because of the lack of Ukrainian air defense. Russia is able to use their fab bombs, whether it's 500 kilograms or 3,000 kilograms. These are glide bombs with precision guided capability. Russia is able to drop these bombs outside of the umbrella of Ukrainian air defense when Ukraine has air defense. And these bombs are just devastating. It doesn't matter how well trained you are. My father used to, when I told him I was going to join the Marine Corps, he said, "Why?" And I said, "Because they're the best. That's the If I'm going to go to war, I'm going to go to war with the best." And he said, "You know that you'll get all that training, and as you approach the beach and the landing ramp goes down, some poorly trained 20-year-old farmer is going to put up his rifle, close his eyes, and pull the trigger, and the bullet's going to hit you right here in the head, and you're dead. And all your training doesn't matter because war is a very random thing." And of course, he's right. I would respond that my death, though, will be followed by waves of Marines who have the ability to lay down suppressing fire on that farmer, who will cease to fire effective rounds. And then we will close with and destroy him through firepower maneuver. And his final moment will be a Marine jabbing a bayonet through his chest. That's why the Marines are the best. Yeah, we take losses. That's the reality of war. But through training, through superior tactics, superior firepower, you will be able to impose your will on the battlefield. But you can't do that when the moment you arrive, as you arrive, you're being hit with artillery or the bombs. The Russians now have very good intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance of the battlefield. Their drones are picking up the troop concentrations. If the Ukrainians concentrate their troops and keep those troops concentrated for any length of time, in comes the bomb, there goes the building, they're all dead because these bombs are extraordinarily lethal. So as a result, the Ukrainians have to break their troops up into penny packets and start infiltrating the men in smaller units. But now the Russian FPV drones are roaming the battlefield, and they come in and they start hitting them. So by the time the Ukrainians get to the point where they can begin the rotation out, and you've seen the videos, they run up in an armored vehicle and they're literally throwing out the duffel bags and the supplies, and the men are running out. And then whoever's there is trying to run in. They minimize the amount of time, and then they're out of there. Why? You stay there too long. In comes the drone, down comes the artillery, you're dead. But now you're in that building. If the Russians picked it up, you're in that building thinking, okay, I've caught my breath. In comes the bomb. These bombs are now becoming bigger and bigger. Boom, you're dead. So all that training, the months of training that these guys are getting in Europe is no good, because they're being trained in Europe to do maneuver warfare, to do classic combined arms warfare, where you are maneuvering forward, bringing in fire support to, in coordinated fashion to try and impose your will on an enemy. But you're not getting the chance to do that. You're being killed before you get there. When you get there, you get killed. What's the difference between all the money that went into training you or some kid that was pulled off the streets of Lvov and thrown in there with no training? None, you're dead. That's the reality of the Ukrainian military today. They're dying. And they can't be replaced. There's nothing to replace them with. The West can continue to provide the money to purchase weaponry, to provide them weaponry by drawing down on existing stockpiles. But unless you have well-trained, highly trained people to fall in on this equipment, it does you no good. The Ukrainians retain some combat capable units, and they are able to mount a coherent defense. Again, I've said this before, I'll say it again. The bloodiest month for the United States in World War II in the European theater was April 1945, the final full month of the war, when the German military had been fundamentally defeated. They were using the Volksturm, the People's Army. Old men, young boys were being thrown into battle. Poorly trained troops were being thrown into battle. But there was still a core of competent military formations that were able to mount a coherent defense. They were getting destroyed, they were getting killed, but they were still lethal in their final moments. The Ukrainian army will be lethal in its final moments. We shouldn't pretend otherwise, but these are their final moments. There's no cavalry riding up over the hill to rescue the Ukrainians. It's finished. This is why you saw Volodymyr Zelensky dejectedly saying, "We have months left. We are losing men. We can't replace them. We have to have an outcome." And he's right. They're running out of time. They don't have men. They can't replace these losses. They're not going to come up with the 200,000 that they need. And when you don't have the 200,000, again, I'll use history. We talk about two battles separate about a year in World War II. One was the Battle of Kursk, where the Germans brought up their strategic reserves and they launched an offensive against the Russians. The Russians held the offensive and counterattacked and drove the Germans back, defeating the Germans. But this did not lead to the collapse of the German army, because the German army still retained enough combat coherence that the Russians ran out of steam and the battlefield stabilized. In 1944, though, the Russians launched what's known as Operation Bagration in July, running through August. Here, the Russians again launched an attack. The Germans initially were able to hold the line, but as the attritional battle ground down, German units were wiped out and they didn't have anything to replace it. And as a result, gaps opened up in the German defenses, and the Russians were able to penetrate these gaps, getting the rear area, creating panic in the other German forces, who now began to retreat pell-mell. And a retreating formation that doesn't take into account maintaining some sort of rear guard action, the ability to counterattack when needed, to attrit, to slow down, it just becomes a moving piece of meat to be cut down by the attacking forces. And that's what happened. This became what is known as the collapse of Army Group Center, one of the greatest military defeats in modern history, because they didn't have enough manpower to plug the line. What happens to the Ukrainians when, and I've been saying this all along, it's called collapse. When the Ukrainians are ground down to the point that they run out of manpower to fill the gap, to maintain combat coherence, collapse happens. Gaps open up. They can't man those gaps. The Russians are able to exploit, and that's the end. This is a situation that's been unfolding since the end of the 2023 counteroffensive. Ukraine chewed up its reserves, its strategic reserves at that point in time. And now what has been happening is that the Russians have been waging a relentless war of attrition against the Ukrainians, pressing forward, taking advantage of their numerical supremacy and their operational supremacy to impose their will on the battlefield, picking battles that they want to fight, compelling the Ukrainians to engage in battles they didn't want to fight in, and getting the Ukrainians to chew up their military. Combat cohesiveness, you know, at what point in time does a unit collapse? You know, that's a question that, the military leaders have been planning or been, considering for since war has begun. When does a unit stop being combat capable? You know, let's say we have a unit that has 100 men in it. It goes to battle. At what point in time does it stop? When it takes 10 losses? Now there's only 90 men left? No, there's still. When it takes 20 losses, there's 80 men left? It's still there. 30 losses, there's 70 men left. You're getting tough now because that 100-man unit is supposed to be doing certain things on the battlefield that require 100 men to do it. Now there's only 70. But if these 70 men are well-led, well-motivated, well-trained, maybe they can get 40 guys. You're down to 60. And now you have problems. It's still, you're not going to be able to do what you're supposed to do. You're going to have to fall back. 50% losses. It's tough for anybody to operate under those conditions because now you're literally one man's being asked to do the job of two, but it's worse than that because the way units are supposed to integrate, you're now actually being asked to do the job of 10, and that becomes tough. And then when it gets down to 40%, you're finished. It takes time to get you down there. What I've said in the past is that the Ukrainians, when they take 80% losses, are supposed to withdraw a unit out, replace it with a unit. That's how you maintain combat cohesion. So you have units engaged on the front, but you also have units held in reserve that then can come move in. By grinding down the reserve units, which the Russians did in 2023, you now have limited capacity to replace the units at the front. And then by keeping up the war of attrition, you are grinding the units down. So 100 men come down to 80, gets pulled out, gets replaced, but now they only have 10 guys to replace. Now when they come back and get rotated back in, there's only 90. And then the next time they come out, they lose 20. Now they're down to 70. They get pulled out, they get replaced, but that unit that replaces them isn't full strength either. And then you keep going. So the war continues because people are like, Scott, you said collapse. Why didn't they collapse? It's a process, ladies and gentlemen. It's a process called attrition, and it takes time. And so you're seeing that. And now what we see right now is Zelensky stating the obvious. They don't have anybody left. So the units that are being called to rotate in, they're at the point where even as they get rotated in, they're not combat cohesive. They can't sustain a meaningful presence on the battlefield. They're getting chewed up. They're dying at a quicker rate. Meanwhile, the unit's supposed to replace them that's pulled up, they can't refit in time. So this unit's getting chewed up. It's got to be replaced, but the unit that's going to go replace them isn't ready. The guys haven't rested. They haven't brought in replacements. They haven't trained. They haven't done anything. They're getting thrown in. So now they're weaker. They get chewed up at a quicker rate. And boom, it's finished. And that's where we're at with the Ukrainian military right now. They're done. And this is why I don't know if you saw the chief of staff of the Azov, you know, that Nazi unit that doesn't exist. It exists. They're there. And he just told Zelensky, don't even think about signing a peace treaty or a negotiated settlement. It'll be the end of you. Once again, Azov is resorting to what it's always done, threatening Ukrainian leaders with death if they choose a path other than Valhalla. And that's the reality of it. I mean, you have the Nazis in control in Ukraine up until the very end.
Do you think that the United States has any sort of leverage on these people, these Azov battalions, or nothing there to help the United States?
Seems to me that Azov has the leverage on the United States. So we just lifted the prohibition against providing weapons and training to them. So who's in charge? we used to at least have a pretend to be conscious of the fact that these are the worst of the worst. These are the scum of the earth. These are Nazis, literal Nazis, literal Nazis. But now that doesn't matter either, because we're in the business of killing Russians. And as long as the Nazis are willing to kill Russians and are able to kill Russians, we might as well give them the weaponry and training necessary to accomplish that task. We have no control over them. We've lost. They control us. They're in charge. I mean, think about it. We call Zelensky the greatest democratic leader in modern history. I mean, he is the Winston Churchill of Ukraine. He's the best of the best. We support him dearly. We love this guy. He's democracy personified. He was just threatened by the head of Azov. Well, wait a minute. What happened to democracy? What happened to Zelensky being the democratic leader? He was just threatened by the Nazis. Now, normally we would say, well, that can't happen. Let's take the Nazis out. I mean, it's a good time for America to come in with its weaponry and kill all the Nazis. Amazing. That'd be the one thing I would support right now. Americans killing Nazis. That would be an amazing thing. But we're not. Because Zelensky's not a democratic leader. He's not the leader that he doesn't control Ukraine. We control Ukraine. And one of the mechanisms we use to control Ukraine are the Nazis. So that's where we're at right now. This is it's an embarrassment. It's a humiliation for the United States. My uncle, who went over the Normandy beaches on D plus six, I think it was D plus six or seven, fought his way through France, survived the Battle of the Bulge, and he'd be rolling over in his grave right now, because this was a grown man. He was brought to his knees in tears when I took him to the battlefield, where he was a transport. He was a truck driver. He wasn't frontline combatant. He was doing the Red Line Express, moving back and forth, moving logistics. But his truck company got caught out in the open by German 88s that, in a flash of an eye, ended up killing over 250 of them. We took him to the cemetery in Luxembourg, where they were buried, and he again cried there. But when we took him to the field where the ambush took place, he broke down. These were Nazis. And I remember when we next to the American cemetery, there's a German cemetery. It's not as well laid out. People aren't aware of it. You have to look for it. But in there, it's a mass grave where tens of thousands of German soldiers who've died in the fighting are there. And he refused to go see it. He said, they're Nazis. They're all Nazis. He hated them. Hated them with a passion. We lived in Germany at the time he came to visit us. He was happy to drive through France and see liberated France. He was happy to see Luxembourg and Belgium. As far as the Germans were concerned, there was no love lost. They were Nazis. They were the enemy. And there's the greatest generation of Americans who fought and died and bled and sacrificed to defeat Nazi Germany. And we are disgracing their memory today, disgracing everything they stood for, everything they fought for, by supporting these Nazis in Ukraine.
Yeah, Anthony Blinken is talking about improving air defense system of Ukraine. Do you think he's talking about these 8 air defense system, Patriot systems, that they're going to get from Israel, or they're talking about the new bill of Pentagon that is going to buy new systems?
Well, he's not talking about the 8 systems from Israel, because Israel's not giving those 8 systems up. Israel was talking about retiring those systems back when Israel wasn't getting ready to commit suicide by going to war against Hezbollah. Israel right now is retaining those systems because Israel knows that it has to have maximum air defense capacity if it is going to fight Hezbollah. And even then, it's going to be a losing cause because Hezbollah will overwhelm it. So forget about those 8 Israeli systems. They don't exist as far as Ukraine is concerned. The United States has put in orders for new Patriot missiles. It takes time to build them, takes time to prepare. Those won't arrive on the battlefield anytime soon. So what he's talking about is drawing down, about the direct transfer of American Patriot batteries from American forces deployed in Poland. Batteries that are supposed to protect American forces in Poland are now going to be transferred, and putting pressure on European nations to do the same, for Germany to transfer Patriot batteries. The important thing to note here is that, ask yourself, why do we have to transfer new Patriot batteries? Didn't we provide Ukraine with Patriot batteries before? What happened to them? They were destroyed. What do you think will happen to these Patriot? What is it that's magical about these Patriot batteries that suddenly give them a survivability factor? At least when the old Patriot batteries were provided, they were integrated into an existing air defense umbrella that consisted of old Soviet era stuff, some other air defense systems from Europe. They had an umbrella that was destroyed by the Russians. So now you're plugging the Patriots into nothing. So they're going to come in and they're going to be standalone with limited support from other people. They're going to die. That's the reality of everything we send to Ukraine. None of it has a survivability factor. None of it. Does it complicate Russia's military problem set? Yeah. But Russia's already got a solution for the Patriot. They've destroyed them in the past. They'll destroy them again. So Blinken is just stupidity personified. A man who is saying things because the perception of power that's accrued by saying we're giving patriots to the Ukrainians is apparently enough to assuage the sensibilities of an American electorate on the eve of a national election, where unfortunately the issue of the conflict in Ukraine and the role it plays in potentially precipitating a conflict with Russia, bringing about World War III and nuclear annihilation, the American people are sleepwalking. They're more interested in debating the merits of a brain-dead president versus a pompous asshole neither one of whom have a plan to save America at all. One of them is literally dead man walking, and the other one, doesn't deserve the title of commander-in-chief, even though he once had it. We're worried about that. We're not worried about the consequences of what happens if either man stays in power, lacking any coherent plan on how to deal with Russia, how to avoid nuclear war. Instead, both of them seem to be hell-bent on promoting nuclear war.
Yeah, you talk about these differences between Azov Battalion and Zelensky. Do you think that there is a new report on the differences between Sersky and Zelensky? Zelensky is not happy with Sersky right now. Do you think is it part of that problem between Azov Battalion and Zelensky, and right now between Sersky and Zelensky, or is it something else?
Well, the problem is Zelensky lives in a fantasy land that has Ukraine somehow prevailing on the battlefield, able to pressure Russia into accepting peace conditions dictated by Ukraine that Russia right now has indicated that it's not even going to consider. And Zelensky can't deviate. He's politically committed to this fantasy. And when you have a general who continuously reminds him of battlefield reality, that becomes inconvenient. And so apparently Zelensky wants to surround himself with generals who continuously remind him of how brilliant he is, how wonderful his plan is, and will come up with some military solution where none exists. I'm not a fan of Sersky, but he has a reputation of being a very brutal leader on the battlefield, meaning that, again, I mean, war is hell, man. I wish people would stop pretending otherwise. Sersky has a reputation for aggressively pursuing operations that result in Ukrainian casualties. Sometimes Ukraine comes out on top, sometimes they don't. But he doesn't shy away from war. He's sort of the equivalent of Ulysses Grant without the bottomless reservoir of Union manpower. But the thing about Ulysses S. Grant is it wasn't pretty when he led the Union armies against the Confederates. In fact, many of the battles that he fought in 1864, he lost. The Confederates held the battlefield. But the problem is he ground them down. It was a war of attrition. And he committed his troops, he suffered more casualties than the Confederacy, but he could replace his casualties. The Confederacy couldn't replace their casualties. And Sirski has the mindset of Ulysses S. Grant, relentless on the battlefield, relentless. The problem is he doesn't have the manpower to back it up. And now he's confronting Zelensky with the reality that we can't continue. You know, you wanted me because remember, Zelensky said, I need you to change the reality of the battlefield so that Russia will accept the peace conditions that we are dictating to them. In order to do that, you can't be passive. You have to be aggressive. So Sirski carried out aggressive operations. The problem is the Russians are better positioned to deal with that than the Ukrainians are to inflict casualties. And Russia flipped the script. And it was the Ukrainians who were dying in massive numbers and they can't replace them. And they weren't achieving anything meaningful on the battlefield. Sirski, though, was trying to create conditions on the battlefield that matched the fantasy land that Zelensky's brain resides in. Now Sirski has come up and said, we can't continue this. And so Zelensky's looking for sycophants in the military who will say, we can do this. And this is tragic for the Ukrainian army, because at the end of the day, the only way you can turn Zelensky's fantasy into reality is to have a meaningful battlefield victory over the Russians, which means that you have to engage the Russians in significant combat using forces that aren't up to the task. And then they just die in greater numbers. But now, remember what we're talking about, Operation Bagration, July, August of 1944, the collapse of Army Group Center. This is the conditions that are being raised right now. The Ukrainian army has burned itself out. There's nothing left. And yes, they'll be able to fight and die on the battlefield. And yes, they'll be able to inflict Russian casualties. But we are leading to the absolute collapse of the Ukrainian army. And that's total victory for the Russians.
The Russians are talking about that Kiev was supplied with chemicals and radioactive weapons, and they may want to do a false flag operation. We know that Kiev is capable of doing this, considering what has happened in Sevastopol, in Dagestan, those terrorist attacks. Do you think, is it possible that Kiev goes after some sort of false flag operations?
I don't know what a false flag operation is. I mean, if you have chemical weapons, how is it a false flag? You have to use those weapons. False flag is when you say, we didn't do it, somebody else did it. Well, in Ukraine, who's going to... So I don't buy into the false flag on the nuclear. I mean, there's a theory that Ukraine would, do something in Zaporizhia at the nuclear power plant and blame it on Russia. The problem is, I'll just tell you right now that it's impossible to do so and survive the forensic investigation that follows. The way nuclear particles work, just ask Iran. I mean, the IAEA inspectors go in there and find a particle that's been lying around for 30 years, and are able to identify it, isolate it, and eventually trace it back to its source. Any false flag, so-called false flag provocation using nuclear material, radioactive material, it wouldn't survive forensics. And so it's stupid. And I don't think it, plus it's not going to further anything. It would be an act of desperation. And I don't even think Ukraine's most fervent supporters would support that course of action. On the chemicals, we know they're using chemical weapons right now. I have two friends who were just, two Russians friends who were wounded by a drone, a Ukrainian drone. And they survived the wounds. They had shrapnel wounds, but the Ukrainians are treating the drones with a very corrosive chemical agent, and the burns that appeared on their bodies are substantive. And we know we've seen videos of the Ukrainians bragging about using drones to deploy chemical weapons and coding things. So we know they're using chemical weapons already on the battlefield. That's a statement of fact. But the thing about chemical weapons is that they have zero military significance unless they're used in extraordinarily massive quantities at the same time. It just becomes, to use it the way they're using it right now becomes a, harassing factor. It's tragic for the guys that were hit. What would have been just a small shrapnel wound now has become a massive burn that's extended on their body It will scar them in forever, and you know, could prove fatal, because when you get burned to that degree, you compromise immune systems, infection sets in, you could die. But that's not a war-changing strategy. It just proves the criminal nature of the Ukrainian regime and the Ukrainian armed forces. You know, so no, I mean, Russia's warning of this, but I can't come up with a chemical scenario or a nuclear scenario, radiation scenario that alters the ultimate results on the battlefield.
Yeah, we know that they attacked Sevastopol. That couldn't change anything on the battlefield, but they went after doing this. And
well, with Sevastopol, again, I think their target was a military airfield that was located near the beach. A legitimate target. Let's just be honest. I mean, you're at war. Sevastopol's, you know, the beach happened because that missile either malfunctioned or was intercepted and scattered its submunitions over the beach. That's not the issue here. It's not about Ukraine attacking a beach. It's about the United States attacking Russia. That's the issue here. You know, Ukraine didn't launch that attack on its own volition. It used the ATACMS missile system. That's an American missile system with American guidance system, requires American intelligence to be inputted by American technicians. After receiving political guidance from the American leadership that Ukraine would be allowed to use American weapons to strike Russia. This was an American attack against Russia, not a Ukrainian attack. Stop calling it a Ukrainian attack. The Russians don't view it as such. This is why the U.S. ambassador was summoned by Russia to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs afterwards, and not only read the Riot Act, but told, we blame you. You attacked us. You will be held accountable. There will be retaliation. That's why she went back and wrote a panic memorandum to the State Department to get on the phone to Lloyd Austin. Lloyd Austin made a panicked phone call to Minister of Defense Belousov. We got to keep lines of communications over. We don't want any misunderstanding. There's no misunderstanding, Secretary Austin. You attacked Russia. You attacked Russia. And that's the reality. Every American has to sit here and understand that we would feel the same way if Russia said, we're giving Cuba missiles for the purpose of attacking the United States. And Russia did the intelligence collection that Cuba can't do, then took that information, programmed it into the missiles. It may be a Cuban finger that pushed the button, but it's a Russian missile given to Cuba by Russia for the express purpose of attacking Miami. Now, the missiles may have been intended to hit Homestead Air Force Base near Miami, but instead they were intercepted, malfunctioned, hit Miami Beach. But it doesn't matter. Russia attacked America, and we'd view it exactly that way. America attacked Russia. End of story. No debate. The Russians view it that way, and the Russians are right. What Russia decides to do in terms of retaliation, we don't know yet. But Russia knows who attacked them and has identified them and has promised to retaliate.
It seems that Ukrainians are moving their army to the border with Belarus. Do we know why they're doing this?
Madmen do mad things. There's a theory out there that Ukraine is moving they've always maintained a military screen there, but now it appears that some of the units that are being trained in Europe are showing up and they're going to be moved to that border. Let's just be clear here. Ukraine lacks the military capacity to launch anything meaningful in terms of an offensive operation against Belarus. The Belarus army outclasses the Ukrainian army today, and it's backed by the Russian military, et cetera. Some people say that Ukraine is seeking to provoke a fight with Belarus to compel Belarus to intervene and therefore allow NATO to come to the rescue of Ukraine because of Belarusian intervention. But in order for that to be true, two things have to be. One, the Ukrainians have to be capable of launching a meaningful offensive against Belarus. They're not. And two, NATO needs to be capable of inserting itself into Ukraine in a meaningful and survivable fashion, and it's not. So I don't know what the hell the Ukrainians are up to. From a military standpoint, it makes no sense whatsoever.
When it comes to the Zelensky and his idea that we cannot continue this conflict in Ukraine, as you've mentioned before, do you think this idea came just suddenly in his mind and he was suddenly talking about it? Or he was thinking of what's going on in the United States, considering Joe Biden and Donald Trump? And then he decided to talk about these things on the battlefield.
I think it's more direct than that. It came after the strike against Sevastopol, after the Russians warned the United States, after the conversation between Lloyd Austin and Belousov. I think the United States put Zelensky on notice that this war's over. You have to find a way out. We'll continue to publicly posture in support of you, but this war's over. It's finished. You've lost. Come up with a solution. Otherwise, the solution will be imposed on you by us, by Russia, by somebody. But the recognition is Ukraine has lost this war. I mean, there's a whole bunch of nonsense coming out of Europe. But think about it. France. You know, a month ago, we were talking about French intervention in Ukraine. Nobody's talking about that anymore. Why? Because Macron's party got trounced. Macron is going to continue to be the president, but he no longer has the ability to order troops around, imaginary troops or real troops or whatever. France is finished. Germany is finished. Schulz's party trounced in the European Parliament elections. Europe is finished. Viktor Orban just went to Kiev. What did they talk about? We don't know, but we can guess. Viktor Orban went to Kiev because he's feeling empowered. Why is he feeling empowered? Because all of his European opponents that have been lobbying against him, everything, are crushed like little bugs on a windshield. And Orban now is looking at a situation where Ukraine, desperate for manpower, starting to mobilize the Hungarians of Ukraine. There's a significant little Hungarian population. And Hungary has always said, those Hungarians are Hungarians. And we're not going to let you drag them into this conflict. I think Orban went there and told Zelensky, stop, or we'll stop you. I think Orban's being proactive in trying to prevent harm coming to the Ukrainian population or the Hungarian population of Ukraine. And if Zelensky doesn't listen to Orban, when the collapse comes, and I'm here to tell you it's coming, everybody knows it's coming. When the collapse comes, that little corner of Ukraine that speaks Hungarian will no longer be part of Ukraine, but Hungarian. And that begins the dismantlement of Ukraine. So that's what I think is happening here. I think that Europe is just extraordinarily weak right now. We're going to see a NATO summit where they thought they were going to be talking about one thing, but it'll be a completely different reality. The United States will be overseeing it. It's either going to just be absolute fantasy. I mean, just craziness. Or maybe the United States will bring NATO in and start talking, reality. And NATO has to start thinking about reality. Mark Rutte, who's now going to be the Secretary General come October 1st, has to look at increasingly not just the possibility, but probability that the next president of the United States will be named Donald Trump and what the consequences of that are. And maybe it's better for NATO to align its policies to meet that reality than continuing to overextend themselves and engage in activities that Donald Trump finds reprehensible and will oppose. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see what happens next week, I guess, or in a week and a half, when NATO gathers in Washington, D.C. Are we going to see a realignment of NATO's posture that meets reality, not fiction, not just the military reality on the battlefield, which is dire, but the political reality within Europe, which is incapable of sustaining that fight? So, again, something I've been saying all along, that this conflict will lead to the political collapse of the political and economic elites who drive this war. And we're seeing that collapse taking place.
It seems that Orban was asking Zelensky to go after some sort of ceasefire. And we've learned that Zelensky administration rejected this concept, that they're not interested in any sort of ceasefire with Russia. If they want to negotiate, how they cannot, I would argue that Ukraine would benefit from ceasefire much more than Russia, because they're losing the conflict.
Well, Russia will never accept a ceasefire, so let's stop talking about that. Russia doesn't do ceasefires. Russia does conflict termination. Putin's made that clear, that he's not going to do a ceasefire. There's not going to be a frozen conflict. There's not going to be a Korean scenario, that the war will end, and the war will end on terms favorable to Russia. Ukraine can either participate in a negotiation to try and get as much out of these terms as possible, or they can continue to commit suicide. And as Putin said, the next time we put something on the table, it's not going to be in terms of a negotiated settlement. It's going to be your unconditional surrender with very unfavorable terms to Ukraine. I think Orban was sending a message too, that you might want to do this. You might want to look for an outcome. But let there be no doubt, Orban also put a coin down on the table about the Hungarian population in Ukraine, which right now is being subjected to deprivations at the hands of the military recruiters who were going in and hijacking Hungarians out of their homes and sending them to the battlefield.
When it comes to the relationship between Russia, China, and India, the West tried so hard to separate China from Russia. And later on, we had new movements, political movements between the United States and India to make some sort of distance between Russia and India. Right now, we know that Modi, right after his re-election, he's going to be in Russia. And considering that project, that big project from north to the south, from Russia to India, what's going on right now, considering the relationship between India and Russia?
India and Russia have mutually beneficial strategic relationships that go back decades. But India is also a nation that's very worried about China. And in particular about BRICS and China. They're worried about buying into a BRICS system of multipolarity that is little more than a disguised Chinese hegemony. India doesn't want to subordinate itself in any way, shape, or form to China. The United States is seeking to exploit that by driving a wedge not only between India and China, but also India and Russia. It's going to fail. India may not jump in with both feet into BRICS just yet, but the Indians aren't stupid, and they take a look at the geopolitical situation and the trends, which way it's trending. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that multipolarity is the future of the world. So it's India's job to negotiate the best possible posturing of India within a BRICS forum. And India will seek to do that by sitting on the fence as long as possible, playing off the West against the East, against China and Russia, in particular China. But India knows that Russia is a reality that's there. Russia doesn't put any demands on India, whereas the United States puts excessive demands on India. The United States is seeking to sustain a failed model, the model of American hegemony. Russia is seeking to promote the model of the future. India will work with Russia on how to fully integrate itself into that model in a way that doesn't allow China total domination. And so I think that's what India is up to right now. Desperate Western analysts take a look at tactical decisions made by India that are designed to, maintain and sustain relations with the West as they sit on the fence, and they overanalyze it, overinterpret it. Aha, that means India is being drawn away from the BRICS orbit. India is this. Doesn't mean anything of that nature. India is connected to Russia militarily, through energy increasingly, and politically. Modi doesn't fly to Russia because he's seeking a divorce. Modi flies to Russia because he's seeking to court Russia. And that's what the West needs to understand, that India and Russia are joined, and they're not, the West can't separate the two. The future is BRICS. Russia's an important part of BRICS. India wants to be an important part of BRICS. There we go.
The important things about the Russian foreign policy, Scott, is when it comes to the North Korea, when it comes to India, Russia has good relationship with North Korea, with China, with India, with China. And It's unbelievably the role of Russia within BRICS is so important, so crucial for the existence of BRICS, the way that they're managing their foreign policy.
100%. I mean, look, Russia is a very mature nation when it comes to foreign policy, very pragmatic, very realistic, and also opportunistic to the extent that they take advantage of developing situations. They're not one to let let an opportunity go by. And the United States has made a number of egregious diplomatic errors that Russia is exploiting. This chairmanship that Russia enjoys in BRICS right now is critical. What Russia is seeking to do with this chairmanship is to fast track the institutionalization of BRICS, take it from simply a club, a gathering, a casual relationship based upon potential, not reality, and turn it into reality. To turn BRICS into an institution that can stand toe to toe with the G7, that serves as an alternative to the G20, to diminish the role of the G20, even though they claim that's not their role. Of course, it is, because the G20 is an outgrowth of the G7, designed to be dominated by the G7. BRICS says to the G20 membership, you can be independent of the G7, you can have your own power. And within BRICS, you'll have the core nations that will be able to dominate the G7. But you can only do that if you can match the G7 in terms of, the institutional capabilities. The G7 right now has, institutionalized its policies, its programs, its postures, so they can turn theory into reality more effectively. BRICS needs to do the same thing. And this is what Russia is seeking to do, not just expand BRICS, but to to organize BRICS as it exists into an entity capable of generating collective policies. It's a greater challenge for Russia than the G7, because the G7, just a second, I got a new puppy who's decided that he was going to go on a one-man destruction mode, so I gotta hold him here before he eats everything, chews up everything. But no, for the G7, it's an extension of American foreign policy. So the G7's job is simply to take what America directs and turn it into the appearance of, a communal decision. The G7 makes no decisions without the United States. Let's just make that clear. The G7 is incapable of G7 thought. The United States dictates to the G7. BRICS doesn't work that way. Russia doesn't dictate, China doesn't dictate, India doesn't dictate, South Africa doesn't dictate, Brazil doesn't dictate. It's a consensus-driven organization where the major players have the ability to influence, but what in order to make BRICS viable, they have to institutionalize consensus. They have to institutionalize a communal multipolar feel. And that's what Russia is seeking to do this year, is to create these institutions to begin the dialogue, the conversations that are necessary for BRICS to become an entity that can match not just the theory of policy desire, but the reality, to transfer to transform concepts into practical application. You need institutions to do that. Russia's in the business of building institutions. Russia's the most important nation in BRICS today, this year. China will always be an important member because of its economic potential. But the thing is, for China to take the lead on institutionalizing BRICS, that'd be very problematic, especially for India. But because of the relationship between Russia and Modi, and I can guarantee you, when Modi comes and visits Putin, talking about the institutionalization of BRICS, the role that India will play in the creation of these institutions so that Indian interests aren't overwhelmed by Chinese, power, is very important. Russia, because of the outstanding diplomatic corps that it has, the outstanding leadership provided by Sergei Lavrov, by Vladimir Putin, and others, Russia is perfectly positioned to create the institutions that will enable China and India to function together going forward.